Today, Hopes and Fears, the Property Imperative Weekly to the 30th of November 2019. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our latest post covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. In this edition of our weekly review, we look at the latest market highs, as well as looking at the local scene, including the RBA statements this week and the fallout from Westpac, plus the latest on home prices. And as usual, we'll start with the global scene, but if you want to jump straight to the Australian segment, the time code is shown below. All three of Wall Street's major indices have registered record highs earlier in the week when hopes were higher for the imminent Phase 1 US-China trade deal. US markets were closed on Thursday for the Thanksgiving holiday, but these indices ended Friday's shorter session lower as the US-China discord over Hong Kong fueled investor anxiety about trade talks, and also retail stocks dipped as in-store Black Friday sales appear to draw smaller crowds. The China issue was that President Donald Trump signed the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act and that Beijing was unhappy about it. China on Thursday threatened to retaliate against a US law backing pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong, with potential measures including barring drafters of the legislation from mainland China, Hong Kong and Macau. And on Friday, a Reuters report said that the US government may expand its powers to stop more foreign shipments of products with US technology to China's Huawei due to frustration that a blacklisting failed to end supplies to the world's largest telecoms equipment maker. In fact, confidence that a trade deal was in the final throes, or millimetres away, as the White House claimed, with speculation that an agreement is possible in the coming days, discouraged a more significant wave of profit-taking in the equities or dollar markets. Even a temporary trade truce between the United States and China will bolster business confidence and stabilise overall US economic growth. Third quarter earnings results were not as disappointing as estimated at the start of the reporting cycle. And moreover, overall guidance is not as weak till now as was feared as at November the 20th. 469 S&P 500 members reported third quarter results. Total earnings for these index members are down just 1.2% year over year, while revenues increased 4.3%, and notably 72.7% of companies surpassed earnings estimates, while 57.6% beat on revenues. And third quarter GDP estimates were revised upward from 1.9% to 2.1%. And US consumer spending rose 0.3% in October, marking the eighth consecutive month of growth. And the decline in business investment in the third quarter was revised down to 2.7% from 3% reported earlier. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 0.4% to 28,061. The S&P 500 lost 0.4% to 3,141. And the Nasdaq Composite dropped 0.46% to 8,670. The S&P rose 3.4%, while the Dow gained 3.7% and the Nasdaq climbed 4.5% over the month, and that's the biggest monthly gain for all three indices since June. For the year, the S&P 500 is up 25.3%, with the Dow up 20.3% and the Nasdaq up 30.6%. But trading volumes were light in a truncated session, with 3.55 billion shares changing hands on US exchanges, compared with the typical 6.86 billion. Interest rates were higher as the United States 10-year Treasury yield bumped up to 1.774%, a gain of 0.4%, while the three-month was down 1.59% to 1.582%. A normal curve, of course. The US dollar index stood at 98.27, down just 0.1%, and gold was up 0.65% on the day to 1,470.3. Still well down from recent highs, as we predicted, but it's holding above an important chart support area of about 1,450 for now. West Texas Intermediate crude was off 4.63% to $55.42 a barrel, and Bitcoin rose 4.54% to $7,765. Elsewhere, Japan continues in heavy water, reporting retail sales down 14.4% in October, when economists had anticipated a little more than a drop of 10% after a 7.2% surge in September. Japan also reported a 4.2% contraction in industrial output in October after a 1.7% gain in September, but November's consumer confidence rose to 38.7 from 36.2, and the Bank of Japan meets on December the 19th, but it's not expected to respond with a change in policy, but the government could increase the size of the supplemental budget it is proposing. The Eurozone reported a higher preliminary estimate for November CPI at 1% year over year, compared with 0.7 in October, and expectations for a 0.9% pace, according to preliminary figures released by Eurostat. The core rate rose to 1.3% from 1.1%, which is also a little more than expected. That reduces the pressure on incoming European Central Bank President Christine Lagarde to take any further action at her first policy-making council meeting in 2 weeks' time. That's likely to embolden opposition to any further easing under the new regime. And separately, Germany, surprised by a decline in November unemployment queues, which slimmed by 16,000. Economists had expected a 6,000 increase. It was the biggest decline since February, but left the unemployment rate steady at 5%. On the other hand, October retail sales slumped 1.9%, and economists had been looking for a 0.2% increase. It is the biggest decline in the year and the first since July. The EMU reports the region's figures next week. The Stoxx 600 was down 0.44% to 407.42, and the German 10-year was down 2.68% to minus 0.363. The Euro-US dollar was up 0.09% to 1.1017. The UK election rumbles on with both major parties making big spending promises, which are probably not fully accounted for, according to independent analysis. Polls from YouGov warn that Labour may not pick up any more seats and may lose as many as 30 seats in which a Labour MP represents a district that voted to leave in the 2016 referendum. The Liberal Democrats remain marginalised, and the YouGov poll shows them winning less than 15 seats, and the Brexit Party is projected not to win any seats. Another controversy over anti-Semitism hobbles the Labour Party, while the Conservatives are mired in the debate over the National Health Service. And UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson promised not to raise income tax or value-added tax if his party wins the UK general election, which is on December the 12th. He also promised on a radio show to take the UK out of the EU by the scheduled date of January 31st if his Conservative Party wins a working majority. The pound was stronger at 1.2828 against the dollar, up 0.13%. Generally, the consensus is that if Boris Johnson wins, the pound will be stronger still. The FTSE was down 0.72% on Friday to 7,346. And China's industrial profits disappointed, falling 2.9% year on year, following an equally disappointing 2.1% fall last month. Digging into the numbers, state-owned industrial firms' profits slumped a mammoth 12.1%, while private firms' industrial profits rose 5.3% across the 41 sectors surveyed. The monthly figure for October on its own is even uglier, a drop of 9.9%, an eight-month low. It highlights that the US-Sino trade war is a two-way street, which China itself is not immune. That is despite the euphoria surrounding Alibaba's successful secondary listing yesterday in Hong Kong and China's oversubscribed US dollar bond sale. China's industrial heartland has been hurting from the global slowdown as well. For example, the industrial profits data shows that in the oil processing and ferrous metals smelting sectors, industrial profits have fallen 51% and 44% respectively. The Shanghai Composite fell another 0.61% to 2,871.98, and the Hong Kong Hang Seng Index fell 2%, ahead of what is expected to be another weekend of unrest, after the relative calm of last weekend when Hong Kongers voted in droves in favour of candidates sympathetic to pro-democracy protesters. The UN rose 4 of this week's 5 sessions, and today's almost 0.25% gain is the largest in 3 weeks at 7.0354 against the US dollar. Hi, it's Liz Interruption, but if you're getting value from this post and have not done so, please consider subscribing to this channel or ring the bell for custom alerts. Plus, please consider supporting our efforts. You can make a one-off donation via PayPal, here's the link, or subscribe via Patreon for as little as $3 US a month or more to get access to exclusive additional content. Alternatively, you can also donate using Bitcoin. Here is the QR code. The links are in the comments below. I really appreciate your support, which enables us to continue to make more great content. Thanks very much. Now, back to the current show. So, to the local news. And we start with Westpac, because again, it's clear that the banks still have not understood the lessons from the Royal Commission. Profit alone is not sufficient. There are important community expectations too. US-born Chief Executive Brian Hartzell stepped down last Tuesday, and Chairman Lindsay Maxted said he would retire in early 2020, sooner than planned. This is only days after he'd argued that change at the top would destabilize the bank, and Hartzell tried to stand firm initially. Hartzell's departure, effective from December the 2nd, makes Westpac the third of Australia's 4 biggest banks to lose its top executive in the past 18 months, following a series of scandals and a damaging public inquiry which found systemic industry misconduct. Shayne Elliott at ANZ is literally the last man standing. And it's not over yet for Westpac. Sure, there'll be a fine, which is probably going to be bigger than the $700 million that CBA paid, as two of Australia's top shareholder proxy advisors on Wednesday urged investors to vote out more directors of Westpac. The country's oldest bank holds its annual meeting on December the 12th and has already said the chairman of its Risk and Compliance Committee, Ewan Crouch, will not seek re-election after financial crime watchdog AUSTRAC last week, but proxy advisor CGI Glass Lewis said it would also recommend shareholders vote against director Peter Marriott, a former chief financial officer of ANZ, as he'd been on the board since 2013 when the payments at the centre of the scandal began. And another proxy advisor, Institutional Shareholder Services, said it recommended voting against Marriott and another Westpac director, Nerida Caesar, on the grounds that Caesar was also on the bank's Risk and Compliance Committee, according to the Australian Financial Review. If owners of more than a quarter of an Australian company's shares vote against its executive pay plans at its AGM, as they did for Westpac in 2018, they can call for the entire board to be removed under Australia's two-strike law. And the fallout may continue, as the Australian newspaper reported Westpac had lost a bid to supply loans to a government home deposit assistance scheme due to reputational risk. Australia's 4 biggest banks applied for 2 positions on a panel of lenders for the nationwide home affordability scheme from the 1st of January 2020, but Westpac is now expected to be excluded, the newspaper reported, citing unnamed Westpac sources. NAB, on the other hand, was successful. And Reserve Bank of New Zealand Governor Adrian Orr said that he was very concerned about the AUSTRAC allegations against Westpac, which has a major presence in New Zealand, as he announced the central bank was ramping up its scrutiny of banks and insurers. The RBNZ had contacted all banks to ask for assurance that they were meeting regulatory requirements and was working closely with Westpac's New Zealand subsidiary on the issues that had arisen in Australia, Orr told a media conference. And Westpac shares fell another 0.73% on Friday to 24.52 and is down more than 14% over the past month. The ASX Financials Index was down 0.45% on Friday to 6,074, but is down only 4.57% over the past month. So Westpac has underperformed. And by the way, according to the APRA data which came out yesterday, both owner-occupied and investment lending went backwards at Westpac last month, in sharp contrast to CBA and Macquarie. CR Post deleveraging despite low rates and booming housing markets. The data overall showed very little credit momentum, which is at odds with the claims of massive price rises from some. So something does not add up. and the HIA are suggesting that new home sales are stabilising, if at lower levels than during the boom times. Across the country, new home sales were relatively flat, in Western Australia at 0%, Victoria down 1.2%, and South Australia down 1% compared to the previous 3 months. Queensland increased by 5.7%, while New South Wales declined by 4.9% for the 3 months to October 2019. New home sales remained steady in the 3 months to October compared to the previous 3 months, and are only now 3.1% lower than this time last year when the markets began to cool, they said. There are no indications that new home sales are returning to the levels experienced in the boom years of 2015 to 2017. But the improvement over the past 6 months suggests that this downturn will not be deep in comparison to previous cycles. Well, we'll see. The Parliamentary Budget Office has forecast that Australia's net infrastructure investment will peak at $38 billion in 2019-20 before falling over the next 3 years. This is primarily due to expectations that the net debt of the state governments will blow out to around $156 billion by 2022, which would constitute the state's highest share of public debt in two decades. The level of national net infrastructure investment, as measured by net capital investment, is at record levels and higher than during the post-GFC stimulus. Infrastructure investment has been revised up by a total of $20.9 billion for the period of 2018 to 19 and 21 to 22, largely due to an upward revision in state and local net capital investment of $16.8 billion. Net investment in infrastructure is projected to peak at $37.9 billion in 2019-20 as a share of GDP, and national net capital investment is projected to reach levels just below those recorded during the GFC stimulus period. The substantial increase in state net capital investment is largely driven by New South Wales and Victoria, whose net capital investment for the period has been revised upward by $7.8 billion and $6.5 billion respectively. These increases reflect significant investment in public transport, roads, health and education. The aggregate net debt of the states is projected to rise from around 10% of national debt in 2018-19 to over one-third of national debt by 2022-23. And over this period, state debt is projected to increase sharply, while Commonwealth net debt is projected to decline. Aggregate state debt is projected to rise from 2.4% of GDP, $45.7 billion in 2018-19, to 6.9% of GDP, or $156.4 billion in 2022-23, its highest level in over two decades. And separately, the New South Wales Office of State Revenue released stamp duty data for October, which reveals a massive $1.47 billion, or 23% decline over the past year, and a $2.55 billion, or 34% decline since stamp duty receipts peaked back in September 2017. This follows a sharp 20% decline in property transfers in the year to October and a 30% fall since the peak. The annual decline in revenue has dwarfed the GFC experience, albeit it is beginning to rebound with stamp duty receipts up, wait for it, by 0.3% in October, while transfer volumes rose by 0.2% over the month. Small beer. Tell me again about that property boom. And we had outings from the RBA this week, from the Governor on quantitative easing and Guy Debelle on wages growth, or the lack of it. And you can watch my discussion with John Adams on the interests of the people, Australia's economic emperor will unleash monetary madness, where we pull apart his arguments. And I also discussed the thorny problem of low wages growth, thanks to a range of reasons, including high migration and high household debt. In my post, wages will be lower for longer. The economic indicators continue to show weakness, with business investment easing back and weaker construction work done, both feeding into a potentially weaker GDP number next week. And so to the property news, CoreLogic's latest data continues to report strong upward momentum in their index, with Sydney now up 6.27% over the past quarter, Melbourne up 6.28%, Brisbane up 1.89%, and Adelaide up 0.84%, while Perth is still down, though up last week, and there is still a 21.4% decline from peak in the West. The five cities' three-month move is up 4.68%. To make the obvious point, if these movements were annualised, they would represent massive rises, but I remain sceptical as not all areas are improving and other indices, including the REA series, is not seeing the same growth and prices are still below their 2017 peaks on average. And CoreLogic's annual movements are also pretty stark, with something triggering a change in momentum during August, and we're going to have more to say about this ahead. And auction clearance rates are easing back, according to the CoreLogic series, with a weighted average last week of 68.5%. However, if you do the math, between listed auctions of 2,612 and reported auctions at 1,570, then you get a clearance rate closer to 60%. And for the same week last year, CoreLogic had listed auctions of 2,701 and a clearance rate of 41.9%. Now, I think these numbers are all a bit weird. Again, we will have more to say about this ahead, including some new insightful data that we recently received. But suffice it to say, there are a bunch of assumptions in the reported stats which are not obvious and which will tend to lift the true clearance rates. And finally, to the markets. The ASX hit a high this week, though it was down 0.26% on Friday to 5,679. The Aussie slipped back to 67.65 after the RBA's outing this week and is down 2% over the month. The Euro Aussie cross was at 1.6286, down 0.18%, and the gold Aussie cross was at 2,168.87, up 0.68%. And the Aussie Bitcoin cross was at 11,471, up 2.16%. So standing back, local economic conditions suggest more weakness ahead. Yet the stocks here seem to be following the US, where the current values are probably stretched. But I also think that the Phase 1 trade discussions, even if they were resolved with an agreement, would not tackle the underlying US-China issues. And to that end, the markets are extended. So the question was, will the trend continue through December? Possibly, but the correction risks are mounting as prices rise. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.